SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very happy Veterans Day, good Veterans Day, thank you veterans, Armistice Day, 11th hour of the 11th day, of the 11th month of the 11th day, yeah, all of that. I think it was 2 years ago, right? We had the 100th anniversary. We played like the sounding of the chime or of the clock, I think, for the 100th anniversary. You know, the sounding of the 11, striking the 11. It's certainly around this house with Tina, being home. It's a day off for the teachers, and. It's funny. I think on Monday she said, "Do you want to do XYZ on Wednesday?" And I said, "Why? So what are you talking about?" After the show, she said, "It's Veterans Day." I said, "Oh my God!" forget Veterans Day for a second. What I'm dealing and starting to confront too is that Thanksgiving is staring us in the face. This late Breeders' Cup, having the Breeders' Cup. This laid out the way it did, kind of threw you for a little bit of a loop. Of course, Thanksgiving's late too, right? Thanksgiving. So holiday season, inching forward. I'm just looking here. And that's December. That's not helping us. Yeah, there we go. Thanksgiving. 26th. Yeah, 26th. So I actually broke out a couple of cookbooks trying to, I've tried to explain this. I'm sure we'll talk to Neil too, Neil Kleinberg. That's right. Casey's birthday. I can never get closer than the Tuesday. My birthday doesn't get any closer than the 2022, but Case, your birthday's been on Thanksgiving a bunch of times over the course of your life, and we got Spencer too. Spencer's on the 22nd, so he's had his share. Tina asked me the question last night when she said, "What are you looking at?" I said, "I'm looking at recipes, and including something with the sweet potato." Never was a big deal in our house growing up. The marshmallow topping and all that. But I did find from Mrs. Wilkes in Savannah, the boarding house cookbook, did see a sweet potato souffle that looks good. Going to try that maybe this weekend. For those of you, it's going to be such an unusual Thanksgiving. I think everybody staying closer to home and, for the most part, less traveling and smaller gatherings. And, I mean, ours varies. Sometimes there was that one we did, 2 years ago? We had the one where we had like a extended table in from the dining room into the middle room, the living room. We must have had 28 people. It was crazy. And then, of course, last year there was the auxiliary kitchen experience, and I'm still going to use the downstairs oven actually for the turkey. I ordered a turkey yesterday between 16 and 18. I said, I guess I got to order turkey. That's when it hit me when I was at Ushak's yesterday, and because we have to barbecue. I mean, the weather, the last chances for barbecuing, I think. Although I had friends in Cincinnati, my friends John and Ann Walker, and they would barbecue with snow. I mean, it didn't matter. John would shovel a path to the grill. They literally would grill four nights a week year round. Pretty funny. We'll put the grill away, you know, at the first sign of snow. But I saw the Denny said, order your turkey. You know, you had the sign up. I said, I guess I got to order the turkey. So, you know, usually in the 20 to 24 pound range, going 16 to 18 this year. Anyway, I don't know what got me off on this tangent. It feels actually today like the first opportunity to kind of catch breath. I got to be honest, the you know, the lead up to the weekend, which I really really glad. I mean, I you know, there was some concerns about going and you know, a couple of wavering moments, but was so glad to have been there. And it does. I got a couple of emails. I mean, it's funny how different the energy is when you're on site. And even, you know, even in the case of having a couple of people, you know, we had about, you know, what, one live visitor pretty much a day, but, you know, which is different than our usual setup, you know, where there's a parade of live visitors. It's still just, you know, it just ratchets things up. That's the difference of being, you know, on site. You have, you know, yes, you could have easily, you know, done the same kind of thing, you know, from the home studio, but it just doesn't give you the, you know, that same energy. And yeah, then you got the long, you know, got the overnight drive out of Kentucky, to get home on Sunday, and you still got plenty of, kind of running on adrenaline into Monday and Tuesday. So today's really the first morning I kind of, you know, felt a little bit more relaxed. Still doing plenty of recapping, and Nick Luck is going to join us in about 10, 12 minutes. I want to get Nick to kind of walk through, particularly, I mean, we haven't talked much yet about the winners and the storylines from the European connections. And plenty to enjoy on that front. And so I want to get Nick, and we do this every year with Nick. I do want him to reflect on, you know, on Tarnawa and the, you know, what it means for Dermot Weld and for Colin Keane. And then Adaria and James Fanshaw. I think Nick had Fanshaw yesterday or Monday on his daily cast. And, you know, then there's, you know, the follow-up to the Aidan O'Brien story. And you know, when it comes to Adaria and Order of Australia, Pierre Boudot, who clearly is, you know, the new hotness with a French accent, you know, and then he'll tell you a lot about Tom Eaves, who rode Glass Slippers for Kevin Ryan and Mr. Holcroft, and because Nick says he's ridden quite a bit for Nick, for, you know, Nick's, the horses that Nick campaigns. So we'll get plenty more about Tom Eaves. And he said that was about as good a ride as he's ever seen from Eaves. And it's funny, you know, those were the European winners and the European connections. So we'll flesh those out with Nick. But there actually was a story that, you know, this morning I was going through my list of jocks and their mounts, and you know who had an interesting weekend that people, you know, probably thought, oh, he didn't have much of a weekend, but actually, in retrospect, Ryan Moore. And you're saying, what did he win? Well, he didn't win anything, but the big but. He was third on Lipizzaner, or fourth on Lipizzaner, in the juvenile sprint at 14-1. He was second to Fire at Will, you know, who just had gotten away from everybody. He was second on Battleground as the slight 4-1 favorite. Then he was second on Mother Earth as well at 23-1. And both Mother Earth and Battleground were coming from downtown. I mean, they were somewhat, you know, it's not easy there to, you know, come from the clouds on the turf. And then on Saturday, he came back Circus Maximus, of course, was second in the O'Brien Troika. And he was second in the turf on Magical. So the only horse that sort of not underperformed necessarily, because she wasn't a major consideration. Although she, I'll tell you, I'm just looking now. She went off at 12-1, peaceful. Ended up, kind of chasing the pace and then fading. So that was really the only horse that underperformed, or Terrabellum didn't run a step either at 7-1. But Peaceful was 12-1. So that was his only, non-check, essentially. Second on Magical, second on Circus Maximus, second on Mother Earth, second on Battleground, and fourth on Lipizzaner. Nothing wrong with that weekend. And, you might not realize it because, of course, Order of Australia scratched out of the Bryan Station on Friday. He was supposed to ride Order of Australia on the Friday card. And then they end up getting in to the mile, and he loses that ride to Boudot because he was already locked in on Circus Maximus. But Ryan Moore, I'm going to bring that up with Nick Luck. I've got some other jock notes as well. There were some jocks who, had lots of smattering of success, a win in other placements. And then there were some that really got next to nothing, got kind of skunked, to be honest. We're going to talk as well to Nicole Russo, as promised. Day two yesterday at Keeneland at the November sale. And no seven-figure sellers, but sold some nice sellers. There were some pretty nice hits. 950,000, I think, was the top price yesterday. 975, that was for Polara. We got to get the story behind Phil Schoenthal, who is buying, doing a lot of buying. For Determined Stud, and haven't talked to Phil in a while. Phil, very smart and very interesting. Does some creative things, and he's the whole story a couple of years ago. He's essentially growing his own feed and milling his own feed, and always interesting. So when Phil Schoenthal's name started to show up with alacrity signing tickets, interested to find out about Determined Stud. So Nicole Russo, and we'll also get some of Nicole's impressions from the weekend. Sid flip-flopping. Nicole was going to be on at 10:30, but Sid is on a conference call, so he said, can he come a little later, of course. So Sid Fernando, of course, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill & Dale. And we'll talk to Sid about the ramifications and what some of these wins mean. And when it comes to the juvenile winners in particular, I mean, obviously that conversation with Ned Toffee yesterday, Into Mischief with a, pretty heady Saturday and fold in Highly Motivated. In fact, mentioning Highly Motivated, I do want to go over the non-Breeders' Cup stake winners from the weekend. Actually, we'll do that before Nick joins us in about 6-7 minutes. The win by Vequist, of course, for Nyquist, and Tappet, the sire of Essential Quality. So, Tappet doesn't need any gilding of his lily. There was that Lope de Vega again on Pearl that we talked to Brad Cox about yesterday. And we've brought up Lope de Vega, who's showing up on these shores pretty regularly. And, of course, Uncle Mo got Golden Pal. And Fire at Will is a declaration of war son. The Euro side, there was that Wooten Bassett, who we've talked about with Sid, is the sire of Adaria. And Shamardal, Tarnawa, Australia, of course, the sire of Order of Australia. Tapizar, Monomoy Girl, continues to be, I think Tapizar is going to be hard-pressed to get is it too early? Too early to say, you know, Tapizar's best produce, Monomoy Girl. I think that's going to be a fair. I don't think I'm too far out ahead. And Painter got Nick's Go, of course, for the Dirt Mile win. So there were the and Dream Ahead. I who I know nothing about the Sire Glass Slippers. See if anything goes on. Anything Sid. Any insights? And let's, you know, while we're doing this, let me give you, I want to go through the races. There's been a couple of casual mentions. The names have come up here and there. Nashville, of course, winning that Perryville to start Saturday. And the Spitestown Colt, bred by Brefney Farm. And we'll see. They're looking forward toward the Malibu as a potential three-year-old grade one, the last opportunity. Sleepy Eyes Todd won the Lafayette, and I haven't seen a lot said or written, but I got to acknowledge, you know, he had the wonderful visit with Miguel Silva after Sleepy Eyes Todd won the Charlestown Classic. And then he tried the Awesome again. He went out to California because, you remember, Silva had said with us he was going to take a swing at the brass ring, and good for him. Instead, he comes back and turns back to 7/8, and he was terrific. He was terrific. He went off as the 4-1 favorite, was vying for favoritism, and of course, this was a tragic situation. And as you saw me tweet on Saturday when word came that absolutely Aiden had so severely fractured his fetlock that there was no, you know, there was no way you were going to be able to salvage absolutely Aiden, and so you know, sent out appreciation to Wes Hawley and to his partner Greg Fry, and absolutely Aiden had been a $40,000 claim that, you know, then proceeded to, you know, to really do nicely through the Oakland winter and then into Churchill this summer, spring, and then he won the Good Lord at Ellis Park, and that whole chain reaction, strike that, and for Diodoro and Cherie DeVos Dinar, they all, you know, were gathered up, the two of them, and were okay. And of course, the jocks, it was Chris Landeros's last mount of the day, and Davey Cohen and Tyler Gaffleone shook it off, but that was tough. Sleepy Eyes Todd under Rosario paid $10, the Patio Prado Colt, and that was a big effort. 98 buyer too. This is a nice horse, and see what Silva's plans are going forward. When we get a chance to talk to Baffert, I don't want to forget Merneith, and you know Merneith had been Merneith might have been something of a Princess Noor, right? Last year, she was the sparkling penny that there was so much expectation, and, you know, failed at 1-5 and then at 6-5, trying to break her maiden at the beginning of the year, and then, you know, then broke her maiden nicely on a wet track, tried the Santa Anita Oaks, and was a distant third to Speech and Swiss Skydiver. Now, as the year went on, that didn't, you know, it turned out to be not such a big deal, to be honest. And, you know, it just feels like she has got some more developing to do, but this was a good effort. Luis Saez aboard her in the Fort Springs. And Merneith, not a career best fig, though, an 86 buyer. So maybe she might just be what she is, you know, under that moniker. And then on Friday, that was Saturday. On Friday, highly motivated with a big effort for Chad Brown and Seth Klarman, went off by 4 at 5-2 as the favorite. And that was the start of the weekend, the whole weekend. Joyce Rocket, and I mentioned Joyce Rocket in passing, yesterday or maybe Monday, and Joyce Rocket coming out of that Skidmore at Saratoga that turned around and has produced just a hatful of winners. And what was notable here in the Songbird of her winning here, you know, she had tried the Frisette, and so she was turning back in distance, which we love. She had gone, of course, second to Toby's Heart in that. I keep calling it the Skidmore. I think that's the boys' race, the Bolton Landing. And she was second there. But everybody out of that race has come back to, you know, to perform well. But Joy's Rocket shortening up on the dirt. She broke her maiden on the slop at Churchill. And she's obviously a nice horse with plenty of upside. And then how about Amy's Challenge, her career finale. Congratulations to the Novogratz people and Mac Robertson. She was begging for the wire, I'll tell you that. That came in the McConnell Springs, the Bryan Station, Ever Dangerous. We've talked about George Weaver off the also eligible list at 74-1. And then Rocketry, who hadn't won since the marathon 2 years ago. And he proceeds to win the marathon for Centennial and for Jimmy Jerkins. So there was the undercard stakes, and we've done the undercard, and now we bring in the feature. Nick Luck returns. Nick, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Great to talk to you again.
Nick, how was the postscript and travel home?
Well, I got home. I arrived. My bag didn't. I'm still awaiting it. So that was just a mildly stressful note to end a very otherwise very enjoyable week. But I gather it's being delivered this afternoon. So happy days.
Well, I hope the girls' presents weren't all in there. Are they waiting patiently for Dad's? What did Dad bring me?
That's what I told them anyway.
Well, you better get out to the store at some point today and maybe.
I'm in quarantine.
You're quarantined. That's right. That's right. That's right. You got to lock down. Well, the aftermath, obviously, of another Breeders' Cup, so much to absorb, and a lot of the things we talked about coming in and focusing on the Euro Invaders, there was great success, obviously, Nick, and the stories, whether it's, you know, the O'Brien triple in the mile, the Dermot Weld breakthrough win, the Fanshawe win, and the emergence on these shores of Pierre Boudot. I mean, there's a lot that went on here, and in a lot of ways, the Euro success on Saturday was, I think, as big a story as there was at the Cup.
It surprised me, to be honest. I honestly didn't expect more than a couple of winners through the meeting for the Europeans, partly because I thought that the home team was quite strong in the Phillies race, the Pillion Mare Turf, and I don't think anyone could have foreseen what was going to happen in the Breeders' Cup Mile. That's still a complete head-scratcher. So given that, then, yeah, I think it was a pleasant surprise if you're a fan of European racing, and a pleasant surprise if you're a fan of the Breeders' Cup, getting some different cast members amongst the ensemble, which it did this year. And I think that was probably the most pleasing aspect for me.
Well, let's do it in chronological order. And there was actually potential for there to be even more success, because You Better Believe It ran terrific in that juvenile turf sprint. And with a slightly, you know, less encumbered trip and a better break, you know, we talk about that, about how sometimes the Euros come and their gate work is not as adroit as the North American counterparts, and that really could have cost You Better Believe It, because he could have won this race.
Yeah, he could have done, possibly. The only thing I would say is that I think he's a raw out-and-out 5 furlong horse. But funnily enough, I think it was the last 100 yards that probably did for him finishing second. Otherwise, I think he would have been second anyway, but even allowing for that tardy break. So I don't know whether he'd have won, but it was certainly a super run. He's going to take high order amongst the good sprinters here next year. and they've got a lot to look forward to. He's bred to be a good horse, in fairness. He's by Kodiak, who's been one of the best sources of pure speed in Europe for the last few years. So it was a delightful surprise to see him run as well as he did, but not a total surprise that he was able to cut it in that sort of grade, because he had won the Flying Childers the time before. I mean, the real story is that he represents smaller owners, Martin and Lisa Webb, who are relatively new to owning racehorses of this calibre. And Nigel Tinkler is a man who's been training for a long time, but he's never had runners compete internationally on this sort of scale. So, yeah, again, you're looking at people who are now in love with the event and want to come back. So to that end, it was a great thing, and the horse ran a super race. A lot of the two-year-olds ran really well. Miss Amulet ran well. Mother Earth ran well. I didn't think she handled the track. I thought Battleground, yeah, they looked after him. I think he's shaped like a horse. He might be a good horse next year. So there were plenty of encouraging performances to take out of the first day.
Well, and part of this story too, Lipizzaner ends up fourth, and I before you joined us, I went through Ryan Moore's weekend, which under the radar was excellent because fourth and 4 seconds for Moore when the dust would settle. And I suppose we have to talk about Golden Pal.
I'm laughing because I bumped into Ryan Moore at Heathrow and I sort of tentatively said, how did you find your weekend? And funnily enough, Steve, excellent wasn't the adjective they used. Having bagged 4 seconds. And I said, oh, well, you still won plenty. And he went, yeah, it's not about the money. So, these guys that are competing at the highest level, there's only one thing that matters, and that's getting past the post in front.
Golden Pal's performance, and of course second to the Learjet in the Norfolk, and some of the concerns about the 14 hole and whether he was going to be able to maneuver under Arad Ortiz, and Arad had a very good weekend. This was really well managed, and at a certain point in the stretch, even with Cowan advancing under Santana, it just was obvious that Golden Pal was going to, come off, and he ends up being the lowest price of the weekend.
Yeah, he was sort of brilliant, but slightly alarming at the same time, wasn't he? It was an excellent performance to completely dominate from that gate, but I'm not quite sure what happened after a furlong or two. I mean, there seems to be a difference of opinion. One is that the rider just eased him a little and allowed him to find his rhythm. The other is that he sort of hung around and stopped for a bit and then got going again. It was quite unorthodox, I thought, the performance. He's obviously a brilliant horse, evidently, given that the Coolmore bought him and then gave him back to the breeder because he failed the vet. There's an issue or two there. So I think I'm just going to reserve judgment as to what I think he's going to do as a three-year-old.
Well, we'll track that and plenty of plenty of the Wesley Warden. Wesley got to take a tally of all the Wesley activity. Actually, I haven't gone back and looked. I do want to mention in the boys' race, which has been a strong event when compared to the filly turf on the juvenile side, this was dotted with half the field essentially was imports, and two of the horses, Nick, that I think a lot of people were trying to make from a price standpoint really underperformed. Go Athletico, I mean, barely got a call, and New Mandate seemed to drop anchor.
Yeah, Go Athletico was a bit disappointing, really. Might just been a bit too much for him. New Mandate just, he was revved up anyway. He was lit up on the way to post. That's the last thing you want in one of those two-year-old mile races, isn't it? A horse to be really lit up and on the metal, because as soon as the traps opened, he was starting to grab a hold with Frankie, and then he got a bump, and that was game over. You know, that picture of Frankie's face as the horse's ears are practically in his mouth told the whole story. So that was it for him. He is a talented horse with a sharp turn of foot, but you can see why they gelded him. Race Beckett said what he was like in February when they had to geld him, and you just want to make sure that his mind is not too fried by that when it comes to rolling around again with him next year. Well, there were a few disappointments in the race, but as I said, I thought Battleground acquitted himself well. It's probably far from the ideal sort of test for him. Cadillac ran well enough, I thought. Mm-hmm. He didn't get the clearest. He didn't get the clearest of trips, but he fought on quite valiantly.
Devil Walla, the race, even though he was going to be a big price, Devil Walla doomed himself with that start where he didn't leave the gate.
And he's
a horse that needed to be in the flow.
Yeah, never at the races. The Learjet, it was an experiment going to a mile, and he was drawn wide, so he was up against it anyway. And what have I forgotten? Oh, Sealaway, I thought, ran quite well for a horse who was completely unproven on that sort of surface. I think he probably will continue his progress next year and be capable of holding his own at a fairly high level back on soft ground in France.
Turn to the fillies, and you know, after it became obvious that no one was going to catch on Pearl, here came Mother Earth and Miss Amulet. Campanelle ran well enough chasing, and I don't know if that was, you know, the ideal scenario for her.
Well, taking them in sort of reverse order, I thought Campanelli just didn't stay, did she? So she'll go back and be a sprinter. She ran respectably, as you say. Miss Amulet, again, suspect stayer at this distance, but I expected her to run quite well, and she did. I thought Julien Leperu gave her a nice ride because he was prominent enough with her whilst trying to save a little bit. And again, I thought she shaped like the clear second best behind a very good winner. I think Miss Amulet wouldn't have gone quite close to winning 6 out of 10 of these. But Aunt Pearl was very, very good. And I thought she paid for trying to chase her late and then got done on the line by Mother Earth the second. And Mother Earth has done well. I mean, she had Group 1 place form, don't forget, in the Phillies Mile. And I think that the track didn't really suit. She didn't seem on an even keel. And Ryan was sort of really having to drag her off, trying to lug right down to the far rail all the way up the straight. So I thought she did quite well. I was quite encouraged by the performances of both of those horses.
Explain to everybody, Nick, the calendar when it comes to the two-year-olds turning three, because this is always the end of the flat season. When will they gear up again? And so people that maybe latched on to somebody and are going to look forward to the classics next spring and into the early summer.
Yeah, so the big early tests for sort of miling three-year-olds with the 1,000 and 2,000 guineas, they take place the first weekend in May in a normal year. And a lot of horses now are aimed straight for those races without a trial. They get their prep work done at home or in a race called Gallops. But the traditional trial races for those take place in England anyway, at Newbury and Newmarket in April. And there are several trial races in Ireland. They get going a little bit earlier. They get going to the back end of March, really, with some of their trials. The Irish guineas take place a little bit later, and then the French guineas between the two. So, yeah, there's an English, Irish, and French 1,000 and 2,000 guineas program. And then after all the guineas are done, then the horses will either go up in distance to races like the Derby or the Oaks, or they'll stay around a mile and run in races like the St. James's Palace Stakes or the Coronation Stakes. And then when you get to the end of June, after Royal Ascot's done, then you start looking to taking on older horses if you so choose. So there are still options to race exclusively against three-year-olds.
Nice, because of course it's different. We'll continue on between New York and Aqueduct and Del Mar and Churchill. This is going to be a big two-year-old meet from here through Thanksgiving. At the Downs yet. Let's turn to Saturday. Nick Luck with us and recapping and the turf sprint, which we've talked about several times and over the years, and have always wondered what it was going to take for an invader to succeed. And you know, when we talked on Thursday, all you had to do was see the company that Glass Slippers has kept to appreciate how nice of a filly she is. And then she got a ride that will absolutely stand up in Breeders' Cup history. And you had particular appreciation for Tom Eaves and what he did here.
Oh yeah, I've known Tom a long time. He's been riding a good while now. He's impossible not to like, which is irrelevant, but it's a fact. And he might have given horses better rides than this, but if he has, I haven't seen them. It was a terrific ride. It really was. He just sort of approached the entire task with a complete unflappable confidence for someone who'd never been in this sort of environment before. Yes, he's had 5 wins at Group or Grade 1 level, but he's a little bit better than a journeyman jockey. But I think that would be a reasonable way to describe him. Yeah, he's not big time, and yet he absolutely repaid the faith and loyalty of his boss, Kevin Ryan, and the owners, Terry and Margaret Holcroft. He gets on really well with his filly. He obviously had loads of confidence in her. And he seemed to have no doubt that she would be able to hold her own, and no doubt that she'd be able to handle the track. I was down at the gate for that race, and I was right alongside the gate. And as soon as she got out on terms, I thought, "Well, you've got half a chance now, filly, because you'll keep trying, and as long as you're not detached, you're going to run well." And of course, she didn't get detached, and then she just found that dream scene. But there was a nice bit of race riding from Tom Eves late when it just started to get a little bit tight there, and a few of them were backing out of it because they didn't have the tactical speed to get in the hole, and he just gently muscled himself into the right spot against some riders who'd have a lot more experience around that track. I thought, yeah, good on you. And she's not the best horse who necessarily won on the night, but she has hopefully opened the floodgates for more sprinters coming over for that race by showing it can be done, and it was a splendid victory.
When you look at a set of PPs like this, and you see races like the Prix de la Baie, a win and a neck beat, the rest of the Goodwood and Cora and Ascot and so forth, the King's Stand. I mean, she was so much the class of this race. 10-1 feels like an absolute gift in retrospect, if you believe that the conditions, the turn, having to make the first time around a turn, if that was going to work for her.
Yeah, I mean, she'd been around the bend once before and had handled it okay, and so but not at this sort of level, so that was a bit of a worry. But she's handy, and she's tough, and it worked. But yeah, as you say, you look at the races she'd been running in, but what it makes you think now is, all right, well, which other horses might be coming or might have come? And the obvious answer is, well, Batash. And it was very disappointing that he didn't come this year. He's the best sprinter in the world on any given day. And I honestly think if he adapted to it, they wouldn't see which way he went. if he settled into the bend, that would be the big if for him. But if he settled into the bend, they wouldn't see which way he went. And to be honest with you, given that it makes it less of a stamina test rather than more of one, I would have thought he'd be a player.
In retrospect too, and I'm just noticing this, and it occurs to me because I had brought up Equilateral earlier in the month, or in October, talking about prospective horses. How disappointed at seeing her win must Charlie Hills be, knowing, right?
Very. I mean, I'm not quite sure how Equilateral didn't get a run. I think he was hard done by not to draw into the field. He really was. I'm not quite sure how the international handicappers came up with that. I think his form was easily good enough that at its best to be drawn into that field. He certainly was among the 14 best. No doubt about that.
Yeah.
He's a horse with a little bit of a hole in the middle, I think, and it's my hunch, and I've no evidence to back this up, but it's my hunch that he's the sort of horse who would improve for Lasix, and I don't think he'd have a problem going around a bend. Charlie Hills has got to be looking at that race and thinking, well, I should have taken Batash for a start, because, Batash has thrashed glass slippers, any amount of time, and an Equilateral would have been a lively long shot. Anyway, no use crying over spilt milk. We've got a great winner of the race, all power to them, and hopefully she'll be back next year.
Well, and he might be too equilateral because he's a gelding. So there is that possibility that he makes a chance at it next year. Let's talk about one of the really, you know, some of these races were, you know, pretty much decisive, you know, clearly, you know, decisively won, and then there was arguably maybe the best raw race of the afternoon. In a lot of ways, which was the filly and mare turf. And Adaria and Rushing Fall hooking up, you know, for that stretch run. And, you know, this was the introduction of sorts to Boudot and what, you know, would become a double for him later in the afternoon. But talk about Adaria and Rushing Fall.
Well, Adaria has been brilliantly trained because she clearly isn't totally straightforward, and she's come a very long way in a very short space of time. And James Banchell used a race that he's particularly fond of, which can sometimes come up a little bit weak for a Grade One, the Romane at Deauville, and he's won it before with Ribbons and one other filly whose name has momentarily escaped me. It's the third time he'd won that race this year, and then the pattern just led him beautifully into this. I mean, for a trainer who's had as much success with the horses that he's had as him not to have had a runner in the Breeders' Cup was the biggest surprise, but it was lovely for him to be able to show his abilities because he's got the absolute maximum out of this filly. And it's great that she's staying in training next year. So super ride. I got a message when I was doing the Winner's Circle presentation from Jerry Bailey saying, please tell Pierre-Charles Boudot, that was an absolutely brilliant ride. Now, those compliments don't get dished out by the great man, you know, like confetti. You know, first Breeders' Cup ride, he'd made a big impression. The second one, well, goodness knows how that happened. We'll talk about that in a minute.
There were a lot of things that went on in here that need to be included in the conversation, and part of it goes to the outside, and I'm not sure, you know, what the rush was for Shane Foley on Cayenne Pepper. What was that?
I don't know, really. I she's a filly that they fancied quite a bit to run a big race, and I think possibly going through Shane Foley's mind was that they'd been musing earlier in the season whether she was a mile and a quarter filly and a mile and a half filly. So with that in mind, they probably thought that a mile and 3/16 was on the sharp side for her, and they wanted to make the most of her stamina. And they'd seen one or two of the grass races play out by that point, and it looked as though speed was holding up. So I'm guessing that's what the logic was behind sending her. So there you go. That's what I would imagine was going through his mind. It didn't work, but don't forget, she wasn't on LASIK.
What it did, though, it did affect this race because Mean Mary, who was always going to be prominent, and to some extent Rushing Fall, they were kind of caught up in the draft. It had to have cost Rushing Fall.
It oughtn't to have... I wonder what I don't know. I haven't spoken to Graham since the race, but I wonder. I doubt he wishes he put Mean Mary in the turf because I don't suppose it, you know, even a kind reading of it would have him think he could have beaten Tanawa. So what he probably wanted was this group of horses, but a 10 furlong race where he's not going to get quite as much pace pressure. You know, she's a galloping filly. Who probably wants a Churchill filly and mare turf over? Is it over 11? Isn't it at Churchill? Rather than a 9.5 furlong filly and mare turf here, or certainly not a 9 furlong filly and mare turf at Del Mar. So, you know, she wants more of a distance of ground, less of a test of a turn of foot, maybe Mean Mary. And so, as you say, getting Harry on the lead probably wasn't ideal. And same comments apply to Rushing Fall, and Rushing Fall is probably a bit unlucky because this is probably further than she wants, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, a flat mile and an eighth would have been ideal for her. And again, you know, next year at Del Mar would have been right up her street, you'd have thought.
Well, she ends up her career 5 of 7 at Keeneland with a second, and I thought she ran a absolutely heroic race.
Oh, she ran a great race. She ran a mighty race, rushing fourth. But it's the Goldilocks race, isn't it, for Ordaria? This is probably absolutely right on the button for her.
Well, and it, you know, to some degree, it reminded me of Queen's Trust.
Yeah, I think she's a better filly than Queen's Trust because I think she's open to a bit more progress. I think she'll be back next year, and I think she'll keep improving. I don't think this is. And Queen's Trust was cleverly placed to win a thin edition of this, and I think Ordaria might keep moving forward if mentally she can stay in the right slot.
I know that Fanshawe was on with you either yesterday or Monday, and he seems like kind of a, you know, John Gosden light.
James Fanshawe.
Yeah, he had that the hat and I got kind of a Gosden buzz just observing him.
Yeah, I'd say they're quite different personalities. John and James, obviously both elegant dressers, but I'd say different personalities. James is probably a little more diffident. Less of a sort of obvious sort of statesman of the turf type, but an absolutely brilliant trainer, very very nice man, James Fanshawe, and just a deep thinker about the game, and someone who probably wouldn't aspire to have the 250-300 horse stable that some of the bigger new market stables have, but with probably 50 odd horses every year. He always churns a good one out. He invariably gets a Group 1 winner every year of some description. I mean, his most prolific horse has been Soviet Song, another brilliant filly.
Right.
And she would have been, you know, she would have picked these lot up and carried them, but he's trained some very, very good ones.
He had that good sprinter.
He's had loads of good sprinters. He's had Frizzanti, Deacon Blue, the Tin Man. He's had any number of good sprinters of Grade 1 status. And he also, in his first season, I think, with a license, he trained Environment Friend, who was a surprise winner of the dance. He ran in the Derby and won the Eclipse, Coral Eclipse. And then the following season, over jumps, he won the Champion Hurdle for Sheikh Mohammed with Royal Gate, who was a 9-year-old who'd come back from a 2-year absence, having previously been disqualified from winning the Gold Cup at Royal Ascot. So he can do pretty much anything. He's won 2 Champion Hurdles. He's won races over fences at the Cheltenham Festival, but he mainly trains on the flat, and he's trained tons of Group 1 winners. So this was a really, really deserving victory.
The one I was thinking of, I just looked it up. What I was thinking of was Society Rock.
Well, Society Rock I didn't even mention. Yeah, another Group 1 sprinter, but he's trained a stack of them.
The filly and mare turf, to me, in a lot of ways, the best, the most exciting race of the day. Let's talk about the mile. And I specifically brought up with you the travail of O'Brien and the barn over these last 6 weeks. I think nobody would have been stunned by an O'Brien win in the mile or maybe even an exacta, but a triple. And with this winner, explain what happened, because nobody understood it on track Saturday.
Right. So there's a set. So in hindsight, there is a set of circumstances which explain why Order of Australia won the race. And those circumstances are, trip, ground, etc. But cutting back dramatically in distance to a mile, experiencing genuinely firm ground for the first time, being administered with Lasix for the first time, getting a different type of ride in the blinkers, admittedly he'd worn the blinkers for a while, and possibly the biggest one of all, the fact that on pedigree, he's a half-brother to Iridesa, who won the filly and mare turf last year, bred by, guess who, Aidan O'Brien and his wife Anne-Marie, who, by the way, still own a stake in the horse. So there you go. And the fact that they even bothered entering him in the first place, even though he had no credentials to be entered, apart from the one. So those are the reasons why he won the race. But to have foreseen that, you would have had to have prophetic skills of astronomic proportions. And I don't know anyone who foresaw that. Even a pedigree expert who noted the coincidence of pedigree would have struggled to have gone to the windows, I think. So if any of you did, then I tip my hat to you. Absolutely brilliant. Because the one thing I didn't think was that he was a miler. And
amazing.
He suddenly looked like a fast horse. Extraordinary.
Amazing.
I'd leave him in America, personally. I think he'd absolutely clean up, but I don't suppose they will.
You were out on the turf course, at that point for the broadcast. And when they post-paraded, and I spent the afternoon, down on the apron adjacent to the winner's circle, and he came up the stretch with Boudot, and he balked at going, over onto the grass for a minute. So Boudot took him off a little bit past the opening. And that was the first time I really, other than seeing his name, number 15 on the AEs, it was really the first time I had any inkling. And I looked at him, and I thought to myself, I said, this is a nice-looking horse. And I just started to laugh, Nick, watching the stretch run. I said, oh, my God, this horse is going to win. And, here came Circus Maximus chasing him and Lope Fernandez, who, in fact, his price did cut in half almost from 30 to 18 to 1. And he ran the race that you and others anticipated. And then when the dust cleared, I realized, oh, my God, O'Brien's 1-2-3.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? I talk about the pedigree, right? You know what else about this horse's pedigree, Steve?
Hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So, Aidan O'Brien, or Anne-Marie, his wife, bought the dam of Order of Australia and Iridesa, two Breeders' Cup winners, right? Two Breeders'
right.
Cup winners out of the same
right.
mare, sent as Dream. She was unraced. She never ran. They bought her for 14 grand. 14 grand. Having produced some, fairly indifferent offspring. Center's Dream was an unraced daughter herself of a mare called Darine.
Wow. Yep. Yep. There you go. So there was Breeders' Cup.
I mean, it's everywhere. It's everywhere
yep.
you look. The mare who defeated the Great Banks Hill at Arlington Park. Was it
yep.
Bobby Frankel's first Breeders' Cup winner? Or no, not quite. But
no,
right
he had won. He had won with the Sprinter. He had won with
yeah,
the year before right. with Squirtle Squirt.
Squirtle Squirt, yeah. So not, but one of his early ones. So there you go. Half Order of Australia, half brother to a Breeders' Cup winner, grandson through the dam side of a Breeders' Cup winner.
Unbelievable. Order of Australia and 270. There was a 70-1 shot off the A list on Friday with George Weaver, and then here's the one on. On Saturday, unbelievable, 73-1, and it'll be one of the one of the great tales in Breeders' Cup and American racing in terms of the tote. Let's
yep.
talk about Dermot Weld's win. And
Before we move on from the mile,
yes.
Steve,
yeah,
first, second, and third,
yeah,
Lasix.
Mm-hmm.
Or Daria, Lasix, Tanawa, Lasix, Glass Slippers, Lasix. Kamiko, Siskin, Safe Voyage, Cayenne Pepper, no Lasix.
Good point.
I mean, it might be a coincidence, but then again, it might not.
Yeah, Kamiko kind of just went around. I mean, he was sitting in a good position and had no finish.
Yep, that's the one.
Siskin... Yeah, Siskin kind of made a little bit of a mild rally, and Safe Voyage just didn't get a call.
Not at the race.
Non-factor.
I mean, you're always gonna get a sprinkling of Euros just not at the races because it just doesn't happen to them, And maybe for the old boy, 7 years old, it was just a bit too much, whatever. But yeah, it's still a notable point that every European. you know, obviously the two-year-old didn't run on it, but every European older horse who raced on it seemed to run well.
That takes us to the feature in terms of the grass side of the Breeders' Cup. And there was a sentimental, I think, root in here, and it was Tarnawa. And when Weld, in fairly early October, made it, you know, evident that, you know, she was going to, you know, she was going to target Breeders' Cup. I remember, you know, noting to everybody, this is a serious, serious player. Most typically, you know, most notably that she was going to go turf rather than filly and mare turf. And she lives up to it. And, you know, there was the drama involving Soumillon not being able to ride because of COVID and concern over Colin Keane. People said, don't worry, he's highly capable. And Dermot Weld gets an elusive win in the Breeders' Cup, his first.
Yeah, much deserved. I think he'd had 17 runners in Breeders' Cups, which is quite a lot for a European trainer. And given his pioneering nature in the late 80s, early 90s and beyond, it was only fitting, really, that he should win a Breeders' Cup race. 1990 Belmont Stakes, 1993 Melbourne Cup, 2002 Melbourne Cup, any amount of other big, important races at Arlington Park and Hollywood Park and elsewhere. And it was fantastic. At Derby at Epsom with the late, great Pat Smullen, of course. And I think you know, it's only fitting that Pat should be remembered, as Dermot did later that day, said that, you know, he mused as to how much he'd have enjoyed riding Tarnawa. And Pat was actually at Leopardstown last year, the Curragh, I should say, on his great fundraising day last year when Tarnawa had first given notice of her significant talent. So it was entirely fitting for all sorts of reasons that she was to win this race. And she's a very talented filly. It goes against the grain for His Highness the Aga Khan to even race four-year-olds, let alone 5- and 6-year-olds. I'd be really interested to see whether she comes back into training next year. Maybe as time passes on, he'll have a bit of a rethink about his policy, and he will let Dermot have another go with her, because I think she's got more to achieve.
Tell us a little bit more about Colin Keane too. I was when I mentioned online that on Twitter that, you know, it seems like based on Weld's comment when the Soumillon news broke, that, you know, she was not completely straightforward to ride, and so, you know, that those comments from Weld kind of made you be a little concerned, but people said Keane is a champion, Irish champion jock, and he certainly lived up to that billing.
Yeah, he's a fantastic rider, Colin Keane. I don't think I'm telling anybody anything they didn't know if they've seen him ride. Joe Lyons, who's been Keane's boss for several years now, has been telling everybody who cared to listen that he feels he's the best jockey in Ireland, if not the best jockey in Europe, and he's starting to live up to that billing too. Yeah, he'd already won two classics this year, the Irish 2000 Guineas on Siskin, the Irish Oaks on Even So. He gave a horse to Johnny Murta's Champ as Elise, a wonderful ride to win the Matron Stakes on Irish Champions Weekend. He rode his first winner just 10 years ago, but he's been champion jockey both in 2017 and this year, and he just nudged ahead of Shane Foley in the final days of the season this time. So it was a great week for him, with 100 winners and the title in Ireland and a Breeders' Cup turf winner. And he clawed back a deficit of 20 from the 20th of August to the end of this truncated season to beat Shane Foley. It was a remarkable run, and he is a very, very talented man.
Tarnawa, magical, ran very well, just could not withstand Tarnawa's late charge.
No, I think Magical's win against Gayath in the Irish Champion Stakes just took the edge off her. I think that was her seasonal best. Well, I don't think, I know it was her seasonal best, but I think her two subsequent efforts, she just looked a little bit laboured, really. You know, she ran really well the other day, but she was off the bridle a fair way out. I think she was probably signalling that race was just, you know, she was just coming to the end of her tether. The weird thing is, and this was pointed out to me yesterday, that Highland Reel ran a similar sort of race at Del Mar when he was trying to defend his crown. And I thought, oh, he's had enough of the season. And then lo and behold, he comes out and bolted up in Hong Kong a few weeks later.
That's right. That's right.
She's going to do the same thing. But she's definitely taken, she's definitely, I think, just been a step short both runs since that, since the Irish champion.
I got to mention, too, Lord North's effort. And, you know, this is a gelding, so, you know, he's going to be around, I imagine. You know, Gosden and Godolphin, you know, was coming off of, you know, really difficult effort in the, you know, on the soft turf at Ascot in the Champion Stakes. And I thought he acquitted himself nicely. I mean, he got beat a couple of lengths, two, three lengths, and ended up fourth. Seems like a nice horse.
Well, it's not an entirely insignificant performance, because there's nothing about his profile hitherto that had made you think that he wanted a mile and a half. And I think he showed that he was probably fine at a mile and a half under those conditions. His brilliant win at Royal Ascot earlier in this season, when he thrashed Dave in the Prince of Wales Stakes, it was a poor time, and I think it was a bit of a falsely run race where he might have been significantly flattered. And certainly it stands out as a bit of an aberration against the rest of his admittedly quite useful form. So I think probably Saturday night was a better, was probably what Lord North is just about capable of now. And because, as you say, he is a gelding, and he is a very useful horse, I think, again, international campaigns for him are going to be the order of the day. I don't think he's going to be quite be able to win a whole stack more all-aged, all-gender group ones in Europe. I think, even though he's won one, I think, you know, funnily enough, if it still existed, a race like the Arlington Million would be his for the taking next year, but there you go.
And Mogul. I tabbed Mogul, and probably was a bad pick on my part, but I was trying to...
It wasn't a bad pick on your part. I mean, I nearly got suckered into that project as well. I mean, luckily I was just about resolute enough on Tanawa, but... Mogul looked spectacular beforehand, but he often does. Yeah, he looked the best I'd seen him all season. He was, you know, coming to a peak. PC was on a roll. He'd won the Grand Prix de Paris with him. You know, what wasn't to like about Mogul? But I don't know. I think he's just the sort of horse that's destined to infuriate you, because he's probably just not quite as good as he thinks he is.
And sometimes those kinds of horses, you know, they'll surprise you. That's the kind of horse that you basically abandon, and then they beat you.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not calling him Tacitus, but you know.
Oh, hey now.
is this a Tacitus free zone, this show?
No, we have a lot of fun with Tacitus. He's a good sport. So
it depends. Doesn't your view of Tacitus sort of slightly depend on where in the country you come from as well?
I don't know. I think there's an equal opportunity to be dismissive and to use him as a punchline.
He'll probably end up winning the Saudi Cup and being the world's richest. Whatever.
Exactly. And speaking of which, Nick, I always feel like I pigeonhole you too often when we focus on the Euros that come across, and then we talk about them, you know, on the back end. Your other impressions of the weekend. You've done enough of these cups. How did this stack up?
Well, Brad Cox can train, obviously, can't he?
Yep.
I thought Aunt Pearl was very good. I thought Nick's Go was very impressive. What did I think of the classic? I don't know, really. It didn't grip me as a spectacle I'd hoped it might. I had this romantic notion in my head that it would be one of those classics, as the glorious autumn sun was setting over Keeneland, that, you know, two champions would hook up at the top of the lane and draw clear in a race for the ages, and it didn't really materialize, because it was as you know, on the plus side, you had a very talented winner with a perfect trip who recorded the third fastest Breeders' Cup Classic winning time ever in, what was it, 159.18 or something, was it? Something like that. And on the other hand, you had a bunch of horses who you feel didn't really fire. I mean, you could have said, you could have foreseen that Maximum Security wasn't maybe capable of doing whatever he had been capable of doing earlier in his career. But I didn't really feel that any other horse brought his absolute A game. So, yeah, to that end, I thought it was a very, very commendable victory from a horse who's recorded a notable double and I'm sure will make a very appealing stallion. But on the other hand, do you know what I mean? It just didn't quite... I've been looking forward to it so much that it didn't... It just didn't quite leave me kind of buzzing the way that I thought it might.
No, no, that's very fair. And, you know, you certainly come away, you know, respecting what this horse, you know, what this horse was. And I won't even call him, you know, one-dimensional. But obviously he's a horse that needs the lead and does his best running, you know, from... You know, from the lead, he certainly proved that in his high-profile wins and in his, you know, two notable beats. What was really unsatisfying was that you would get to that race, Nick, and handicap it, expecting that, you know, all connections and riders are aware of what is going to unfold, and yet they. You know, they let this horse get out to a uncontested lead. And, you know, Global Campaign, Tis the Law, you know, and I expected that Maximum Security would just kind of stalk. But there were two other horses that were supposed to engage him and not let that happen. And as a result, you know, not that I needed or expected that, you know, the closers were going to come late and pick him off. You know, I thought Tom's the Todd and Improbable, well, yeah, would be the, you know, the ones.
Ask yourself this question. Barclay Tagg trained Authentic and Bob Baffert trained Tis the Law. Would Baffert have allowed Tis the Law to be ridden the way that Tis the Law was ridden? On a track that was souped up to the nines and was massively favoring speed?
Well, exactly. Exactly. And that's the one thing, you know, when Baffert has this kind of a horse, you know they're going to take advantage of the speed. And all we talked about from 3 seconds after the Preakness was over was what was Johnny Velasquez doing here when a month ago he had a blueprint for how to win with this horse. And so you knew going in they were not going to mess around, that they were absolutely going to just go and get the lead, and that's the way this horse can win, period. And then they basically, you know, get things not handed to them, but, you know, certainly were able to dictate.
I mean, speaking of Johnny Velasquez, I think it's worth just tipping the hat to him, not for one, but for two brilliant bits of riding, I think. First, I was particularly pleased for him that he won his Breeders' Cup Classic. Second, his ride on Gamine, I know you could say that anyone could have won on her, apart from maybe you or me, Steve, but, you know, you could have strapped any old prod to Gamine and she'd have won. But the point was, you had to make a decision, didn't you, what you were going to do. Were you going to go and lock horns with Serengeti Empress, or were you going to take back and just let her do the donkey work? But he kind of did both, which I thought was the clever bit. So he got Gamine out, so he was pushing Serengeti Empress through faster fractions even than she wanted to, and then he just gently took back and said, right, go on then, you can give me a lead for the rest of this, and just worked out beautifully. She burned herself out, he got the lead, and away she went. I thought that was clever. But I suppose if you were billing the filly and mare sprint race, that race and the distaff as two great matchups, so Gamine against Serengeti and Monomoy Girl against Swiss Skydiver, I guess that was a sort of slightly disappointing aspect. You didn't get either of those.
No, that's true. I suppose we got a chance for next year because the two of them, of course, will now we got Monomoy Girl coming back and kind of unexpectedly.
Surely.
Yeah.
Surely they'll give it a go. Is there anything to say that Monomoy Girl couldn't run a big race in a Breeders' Cup Classic?
I suppose not. But
you've no idea what she's got left because she doesn't seem to do a tap.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. She has not, you know, because one of the things that's very notable is that from a FIG standpoint, if you're using that as the evaluation method, she doesn't blow anybody out per se and doesn't run, you know, the kinds of explosive races that can take a big toll on a horse either, it seems.
You've got nothing to lose. You've got absolutely nothing to lose. I mean, they paid what they paid for her. I presume they're going to take her abroad somewhere, won't they? They'll take her to Dubai or Saudi, I'm guessing, to try and recoup half the pot back, and then get her freshened up for the back end of the year. I'm guessing.
All right, we'll see how it unfolds. I hadn't even that part of it. I had Brad yesterday. We just sort of were. You know, kind of marveling at the what she did this year. I mean, off of a layoff of that extent,
But then, of course, you've got the kind of Del Mar chaos factor to take into account, haven't you, next year?
Yeah, fair.
I mean, I don't mean chaos as in hectic. I mean as in the unpredictability as to whether horses can reproduce form there that they show elsewhere.
It's a different. Yeah, that's true. I'm trying to think back to a couple of years ago, to some of the unsatisfying. If there were some unsatisfying results or some that I have to go back and actually look. That's an interesting.
Gunrunner dug it out, didn't it? Gunrunner saved the day, really. Because there were some proper head scratches that afternoon until on the main track until Gunrunner did what he did.
I will now you got me. I looked at the Keeneland from 5 years ago. We spent time doing that. Now I'm going to start to look ahead to Del Mar and Nick. In terms of looking ahead, what's your winter itinerary looking like?
What's my itinerary looking like? Well, slightly odd, obviously, given the circumstances. So it was just, I feel very, very, very spoiled to have been allowed to come over last week. And I realized that there were a lot of people who couldn't. And, I'm not doing any kind of faux humility here. It was genuinely a privilege to be involved in the event. So I'm technically in a 2 week quarantine period at the moment. So, in addition to the fact that the country's in some sort of a partial lockdown anyway, I mean, you can still go to work and go to school and all the rest of it, but I'm actually confined to my house because under the terms of the law, if you've been to a country that's not on the corridor, which obviously the United States isn't, then you have to quarantine for 2 weeks. Even though I've passed a COVID test today and I passed a COVID test at Keeneland, so that's something to pass on to everybody. I do not have COVID, having been in Keeneland for a week, which is great. But you are allowed to go abroad again, provided you go straight to the airport. So I'm going to Bahrain on Monday for 5 days for the Bahrain Trophy, and then I will come back and have to quarantine for another 2 weeks. So that's what the next few weeks are looking like. And then there'll be, so I probably won't get back onto a British race course until early December, and then there'll be plenty of jumping, I would imagine, to take us through the winter. I don't anticipate a crown of any description really being on a British race course until, February, March, maybe even April, and then we'll see what next year brings in terms of whether I can travel much. I'm guessing a couple of jobs in the Middle East, February, March, and then we'll see from there, I guess. I was talking about the possibility of getting over to the Pegasus, but again, I think that would have to be sanctioned and mandated, much like the Breeders' Cup was. So we'll see.
Well, of course, the broadcast and the whole atmosphere enhanced by your presence and Nick, last week's preview and this hour. I always look forward on any topic, any of the great international standards that when we get to visit. Thanks so much.
Steve, thanks so much. Always love talking to you. Take care.
You too. And Nick Luck, folks, you can follow Nick's podcast daily. He does a show that'll help you stay on top of the UK and the continent and the racing. So avail yourself, sign up, and take it in. If you know, spend plenty of time talking international, and he is just he's the top. The world's top presenter, as they call it. We'll take time out here, and an hour and 15 in already. Nicole Russo is going to join us. Sid Fernando, Ed DeRosa, Seth Merrow. There's our itinerary. Beautiful sunny Veterans Day, and again, thoughts and appreciation to everybody that serves and served. Back after this, Nicole Russo, the Daily Racing Form.
The latest racing news. The races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Don't miss a second of thrilling live racing from Aqueduct this fall on America's Day at the Races on Fox Sports. Watch Maggie Wolfendale, Andy Serling, and the entire All-Star cast bring you the best of fall racing live from Aqueduct. For full TV listings, visit NYRA.com.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
From BRL Equine, the people that bring you EPO Equine, Unlock, and Bleeder Shield, now comes Flexify HA, the most advanced scientifically-based joint supplement on the market. To find out more, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880. To be the best, give them only the best. BRL Equine.
Sirius XM Sports presents...